You don't like anything too depressing, huh, Jeff? Too scary.
Besides my life, you mean?
Well, maybe that's why you go see those like sweet Disney movies. Which is easier.
Moana sing along. That's for me. Yeah. Little Crystal Meth, Moana sing along.
Yeah.
Yay. We've all had personal experience with alcoholism or alcoholics. And the wall of pain and the wall of shame and the impact that, alcoholism amongst many addictions has on the user and their family members is, one of the more sublime human tragedies. And while I, have lived through it and matured by it, it's hard for me to get a kick out of, in this case, the entertaining exploitation of such a painful way of life. So, the movie, the show is entertaining and treats really serious, human tragedy in a kind of, humorous, rollicking manner. But I think it's way more devastating than the movie lets on.
The people who, some of the people I see, when they see a show like that, it kind of normalizes them, makes them not feel so badly because they have a dysfunctional family, kind of.
That could be a useful, right? Yeah, for sure. That's a useful, what would you call it, decompression, right, for their own sorrow or stuff. Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. The other things that trigger me are those, like the OA.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was too triggering for me because I'm sure in a past life I was, lived in a small box for far too long.
Yeah, maybe.
Because I have a really, strong alarm reaction to, the kind of incarceration that was being exploited in that film. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was upsetting for sure.
What is the OA about?
The OA, angels.
Oh.
Life after death, these people who survive life after death. And somebody locks them up and does research on them.
Oh, I'm like, what does that have to do with boxes? I'm not getting the box for
yeah.
They were incarcerated. They were incarcerated against their will and isolated, from life as research guinea pigs.
Yeah.
Held against their will. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's been all of our past lives.
I know. It's like, here we go again.
How are you doing, MRI machines?
That'd be fine.
I think it's
I don't have, I don't have, I don't have that kind of claustrophobia.
Spatial is the lack of freedom of someone taking away the humanity. Yeah. Sucking you it out of you and treating you
consciousness is just absurdly painful, but since you can move around and get food, it's like, oh, I'll be okay.
Yeah.
But, I think prison sounds so horrible,
Yeah. If you were, if you had all this mind and sensation and shit going on and you were, incarcerated against your will or held in a small container and not able to discharge the horror of being alive by running around outside. It would be like, oh my God.
I know. So, that's one of my biggest fears, getting ALS or, some kind of disease like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in a sense, I kind of like it because it's a deep kind of, reflexive panic. It's an irrational, right, kind of panic. And so there's something kind of pleasant about that. Like, whoa, that was really intense. And so I like to kind of play with it a little bit, what's that panic about? But there's a part of me that just gets, that's enough. Okay, that's enough. Stop playing around. Mm. You're freaking yourself out. I had the coolest I guess you'd call it vivid dream this morning. Oh, it was so weird.
That's cool.
Oh, it was great. I mean, I think it was some cold medication. You know, you take that all that weird fucking cold medication, you add too many of them together, and then you've got like a cocktail going on.
For sure.
A really weird brain cocktail, and then you're sleep deprived because your nose is stuffed and your CPAP machine's not going to work and snot's coming in and out of your nose, and you're like, if I don't get any sleep, I think I'm going to die. And you're too tired to do anything about it. You can't move, so you stay in this zombie land of not sleeping, and it's like, you know, oh, boy. And then when the dreams come, you're like really toast. It was one of those. It was good. It was in sepia tone.
Cool.
It was so bizarre. And it was, I mean, it was like I was, it was, you know, that kind of dream where you think you're awake while you're seeing the dream. I mean, I was like totally awake while I was seeing this dream. And I was making sounds to, you know, in accompaniment with the dream. But I didn't wake Beth up, so I was not really awake when I was thought I was, you know, wide awake. So it was one of those cool multi layers where you're seeing this scenario. And the scenario was really kind of simple. I mean, it was like Guru Prahlad, and I don't see him very often in dreams, you know. So that's always fun when he shows up in a dream, you're like, oh boy, you know, who's gonna die? What's happening? You know, it's one of those things. And a tiger or something, and it was a death dream. It was this tiger, you know, this mighty beast that was kind of, you know, the animus of Prahlad, who you can see was kind of, you know, aging or, you know, lifting up on his hind legs, and he was declining, you know. So I was actually kind of watching the death of this animal, and then Prahlad actually replaced the animal in the dream, and then he lied down in this, you know, interesting kind of outdoor, you know, tiger enclosure or something, and then curled up along this concrete wall and, you know, just went into this kind of really deep peace. And I was watching this whole thing unfold with, I mean, absolutely riveting lucidity and complete wakefulness. And it was, and I was, you know, hallucinating in situ. And so I was just like, oh, oh, oh. I'm making all these noises, even though I'm sure I was fast asleep. And it was like, wow, what the fuck was that? You know, it was so riveting. I didn't, you know, I didn't forget it. I was like, what, what? It was great.
That's
totally
great.
Cool. What the meaning was, clueless. I'm absolutely clueless. But it was just the way that it was displayed. It was like a, you know, a dimension of consciousness that you don't, you know, don't often tap into. I just love those cold medicines. I'm going to take some more.
That's great. Medicine dream.
Yeah, it was a medicine dream.
Yeah.
It was fun. Yeah, it had no meaning. Why should it? Why does anything?
Do you still have authorship in your dreams?
Yeah, right.
I just, like, take a lot of marijuana and black out.
No, that's a way to get through this. Yeah.
Did something happen?
Why not?
Yeah, I really don't like catching a cold, but when I do, there's always that thought of like, oh, I could take NyQuil.
If you were in Shameless, you'd be taking NyQuil every day, several times a day.
Yeah.
Yep. That's all I got. And our friend George from Malvern sent that article about the that tiny little thing the scientists found in China, that precursor little life form.
Oh, really?
Did you see that?
Tell us about it.
They found some fossilized evidence of a really, you know, tiny, like 1 millimeter sized creature that looked like it was all mouth.
The thing that doesn't defecate. That thing?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah,
the thing that has no anus.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right. So it exchanges, you know, food and excrement through its principal and only orifice.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's weird.
Those are my ancient relatives.
That's right for all of us.
Part of them.
Oh, yeah, those
the
guys.
The Baroness line.
I know those guys.
Yeah.
The royalty, the German royalty line.
That's right. It's just another version of the aristocrats.
Yeah.
So that was cool. He asked me whether I thought that that creature was sentient or not. I mean, as a joke, kind of, you know?
Yeah.
Do you think this one-celled creature from 500 million years ago had a sense of self? And I was like, sure. Yeah, why not? Yeah, how could you know? Primal sacred being, right? It doesn't require a complex nervous system to self-realize.
Maybe. No, because I think we tend to think of it like, oh, if you don't like recognize your reflection, then you're not able to like, you know, that's like a piece of it. But it's like, no, you can have a very much awareness that has nothing to do with creating a boundary field around your so-called body, whatever that might look like.
Yeah.
If you're like a amoeba or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Say more about that. Because I tuned out for a second, you know, now I'm caught the end and I just, you know, this is what I do for my job. What the heck did that person say?
Yeah, yeah. That's the way I get through it. I tune out, tune in selective moments.
Yeah. Oh well, it'll remain a mystery as so many other things, I guess.
As most things, yeah.
Yeah.
Somewhat close, you know, slipping from the grasp of knowing, which is like too many things.
Everything.
Everything.
Everything's just slipping away. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that was kind of the theme of our Sunday morning chat at Del Val.
Was what you guys were just talking about?
No, what you just mentioned.
Oh, that. No.
It's all the same.
Everything being a mystery.
Well, you know, we're streaming forth improvisationally in a kind of, you know, joyful madness. And rather than, you know, becoming giddy just with the observation of that, right, we presume, you know, genesis and relevance and implication as a person. But everything you think and feel and everything that occurs and every sensation and every idea and everything and everything and everything and everything is really truly improvisationally appearing based on God knows what and who knows what. You know, it's not the brain. It's not the centers of the brain. It's not neuronal. I mean, it's way, way stranger than being, you know, attributed to what we call the physical body. The waveforms, the harmonics, right? The harmonics of consciousness, the harmonics of sentience, the harmonics of physicality, of DNA and RNA and hormones and emotion and sensation are absolutely splendidly occurring on tap. So this is amazing. This is, oh my goodness, you know, wordlessly amazing, really. But we don't notice that it's wordlessly amazing. Because we've been made comfortable, you can say, with the presumption of knowing too much, thinking that we're behaving in a, you know, what would you call it, a willful, prescribed, choice-driven manner, when we are actually occurring without rule or structure, and that's the liberation. The mistake that incarcerates is the, right, sensation of individuation and durability, individuation and duration. So then life can appear to be a drag or repetitive or uncertain and all these things that we like or don't like. So there's this curious reinforcement of the sense of the person through memory, right? Memory and assignment. And so we become dull. Dull and Republican. Which is kind of redundant. I mean, think of it. You know, if you, let's say you had, wealth or something. I mean, everything you have, it's like whatever you own owns you. So if you have great wealth in a world of, you know, magical sensual delights, then you're incarcerated by that wealth, the accumulation of that wealth, the clinging of the wealth, the adding to that wealth, because no matter how you might spend that money, you know, the sensual delights, don't ever actually satisfy you. So you become, you know, incarcerated by the world through having success in that world, whether that's money or fame or celebrity or running a business or anything. Why did that guy Christ, why did he say that thing about the, you know, the eye of the needle? Right? And the, you know, a rich man and, right, the eye of the needle or a camel or a pin of the head of the pin or...
Right. We get what you're saying, though.
Yeah, some illusion there. So
the love of money being the root of all evil.
That stuff, yeah. So we don't ride on the coattails of this absolutely lucid display, wondrous lucid display, and derive incredible joy and novelty from it. Instead, we become, incarcerated through accumulation. And, you know, the fear of death and the fear of this and the fear of that and the repugnant accumulation and exploitation and the lying and the deceit that goes on is just a sign of how deep that illness can go. I mean, if you're an alcoholic, like in Shameless, and you're, you know, your impact is very large. I mean, you have a large impact on the people whose lives rely on you and the lives that you touch. And if you're the head of ExxonMobil, then you wield, you know, you could say a lot more, capacity to cause suffering, as evidenced by our present, political milieu. So the so-called spiritual seeker, not that that's all that enviable. But it takes a certain, it takes a certain kind of innocence of soul, which I would call a maturing of, you know, the species, an innocence of soul, to recalibrate. Recalibrate with the mystery of being, than to continue to insist upon and derive creature comforts and creature pleasures as an accumulative reaction to living. Like Jack Kerouac, or, you know, some kind of beat maniac that rode the rails and had not a dime to their name and, you know, lived at the mercy of the weather and at the mercy of the kindness of others and, right? Not necessarily insisting they were enlightened or anything, but they were having a certain kind of fun.
Well, there's people out there who seem like they don't care about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Homeless people or homeless, even teenagers, you see, or I don't know what life is like. It doesn't look very free of suffering. But,
yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's easy for me or anyone to draw, you know, a conclusion, whether it's lofty or, you know, banal. And it's like, God, what the fuck is true?
I know. You go in so many directions.
Yeah, it's just, whoop,
whoop. How did that Kerouac die, anyway? You know?
No, I no.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I saw whatever films were made about On the Road and Kerouac and Neil Cassidy and stuff.
I saw the one about the guy he was friends with. The one that Franco played. What was that one? That poet. Ginsberg, I think.
Yes.
Did you know him?
Yeah. Howell. I think so. Howell, yeah.
Yeah, Howell. That was good.
Yeah. It's like, you know, being present sounds like, can often sound like, you know, some kind of meditation agenda, you know, so it's too much pressure. Because being present is like, what exactly am I, who am I, how am I, what is consciousness and sensorial, you know, receipt. And so what do I do to be present or so-called more present than I think I already am? And now you're unfortunately moving once again in, you know, the maddening vagaries of consciousness and the weird, texture of, call it subject and object, of experiencing. And so we, you know, mindfulness or being present, what exactly? You know, there's something other than that. Because mindfulness, if it has a destination, whether it's a behavioral destination or a spiritual destination or a qualitative destination, is another fail.
Anything that relates back to me is another fail. Yeah. That's for sure.
Yeah, like, that's right.
It's just, it's ridiculous. It's like so funny to see that habitual mechanism constantly of like trying to quantitatively put something together and then relate it back to my, like some,
yes,
something I did or something I could share with someone or whatever, you know, yep. Something, anything
that's
that
right. That's right. That's the fail. The fail is the, like, you know, no, the pleasure that's derived from, self-animating or self-affirming. Yeah. That's the fail. Because then the, you know, the grandeur of nothing at all becomes, too particular.
Yeah. Instead of saying the so-hum meditation, we should just say ho-hum.
Yeah. Ho-hum is good. Ho-hum.
Because it does, it's just such a commonplace kind of baseline immediacy that it is kind of ho-hum.
Yes. Yes. Without quality,
yeah.
That's the curious thing. I mean, we think that we're finding all kinds of qualities, and those qualities contribute to our animating and then projecting out as a, you know, call it an individual, right? A space-time wanderer. And all of these qualities that are found and so-called perceived and conceived makes it appear as if I'm individuated and I'm a space-time wanderer.
And I'm in the midst of writing my novel.
Well,
so
we are.
Blogging.
We are, yeah.
My vocabulary and repeating things.
That's what we're doing. We're writing our novel, whether we're typing or not.
As we go.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's our voiceover narrative.
Yeah. That's right. Thank God I have a spokesmodel with me 24/7.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That can tell me, you know, anything about myself I care to know. Oftentimes things I don't care to know.
Yeah, well.
But, you know, these days,
fucked up blended
I don't pay, I don't pay my spokesmodel very much. So, you know, you get what you, you get what you pay for. Hey, you're an asshole. Yeah, who asked you? Hey, you're paying me. Don't you ever go on vacation? No, no. If you go on vacation, I'll be on vacation. We'll go together. But wait a second. Can't we just split once in a while? Sorry, no. It's in the contract. Spokes of Thunder Buddies for life. Me and Teddy. Thunder Buddies for life. I'm only laughing because it's so painful.
Yeah. I wonder why it just didn't evolve into having two heads and it just talks.
Yeah, that's right. That could be easier.
I know.
Yeah. At least that you could if you control good. One or both arms, you could always put a sack over the other head. All right, you go to bed now. Hey, just because you control the arms. That'd be good. Yeah, two heads, but you control both arms. So, yeah, the odd miracle, you know, just to fun to make on to make a put an emphasis on it, you know, the liberated miracle. And I'm not speaking from experience because I don't have any experience when it comes to those things. I just like to talk about them. The liberated miracle is this has no quality. It's not actually demonstrating as it appears to be demonstrating. It's so porous and so impersonal and so improvisationally, you know, strange. That even though it seems like there's a good deal of inertia, being a person who, you know, suffers or a person who is in anticipation of, you know, relief from suffering, that's not what's going on. It's absolutely porous. Nothing, there's nothing here. No qualities at all. And there's no need to resolve or fix or, you know, make amends. They can come in handy. Or do anything at all. That's part of the dilemma, you know, of what trips us up is that we think there's something to resolve. There has to be closure. There has to be, you know, a so-called enlightening experience. There has to be evidence. There has to be something. It's like, no, there's nothing. There's just nothing. There's no evidence.
There has to be something in it for me.
Well, yeah.
Something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise, why would I do it?
Right.
Yeah, that's the same loop.
Fun. Yeah. You know, self-promotion and attention-seeking goes on incessantly with our spokesmodel. And that makes it appear as if, you know, something's going on. And even though none of that need change at all, nor will it, nor should it, you can get a glimpse of absolute porosity. The qualitatively empty aspect of experiencing. And not as the result of, you know, anything. It's not, you don't come to that as really the result of anything. I mean, it's one day having lunch with Petey during one of his visits. We were out at the Penn Tap Room or something, you know, out back having a sandwich, and Luli was with us, and Peter Starkey from Seattle was visiting. And
Yes, your elite group of friends that only, you know, can come to lunch. We know.
That's right. The elite insiders that are, you know, pretty much only the only ones I know.
1% of the spiritual.
Eligible for enlightenment. Yeah. Yeah, everyone else just contributes financially.
1%, we know that.
That's right. You gotta be the 1% somewhere. And there was, you know, we were just, you know, playing around with the vibe of things. And there was, he was just sitting there and said, yeah, he just said something like, there's no bridge. Everything human, everything in consciousness, he said, has nothing at all to do with this. There was just, I mean, it was fun. He was making such a lovely, you know, poetic demarcation, or, you know, drawing a line in the sand between everything that's experienceable and this, you know, call it emptiness or dimension that just, you're like, it's like, yeah, no, it doesn't know anything about human. It doesn't know anything about human. It's not that it's just tolerant. It actually does, it has no record of it. It's like one of those Twilight, you know, episodes or where everyone starts disappearing, you know. This keeps no record of itself. But we keep records, right? How do I show up the same way day to day with the same opinions and the same routines and the aspirations that I have, you know, failed or otherwise? Because I'm record keeping. It turns out that my spokesmodel is also a librarian.
Yeah, you're in the book, you're writing the book, you're, you know, all at the same time.
It's yeah. Like,
but the pages are like burned as you go.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right. What's that sound I hear? Well, that's you being shredded. Oh. That's the freedom, right? I mean, it's hard to articulate. It's impossible to articulate what the texture of that freedom is, because it's so absolutely discontinuous with everything that we understand to be so-called human experience. But we can appreciate the texture of human experience, you know, the spokesmodel, the librarian, the way that thought and experience arises, the way craving arises, attraction and aversion arises, storytelling, right? Aspiration, enjoyment or not enjoyment, getting out on a weekend to go do something novel and eat at a, you know, a place I've never eaten at before, walking a dog, whatever it is we're doing. And this presence, this companion reality is like not even registering any of that. You know, all the things that we have to write home about, this miraculous silence is, it's not even on its radar. That's how, you know, trying to lean a little bit into the contrast, I guess, between everything that makes us what we think we are and this present, prescient companion, call it reality, that has no quality at all. And it is not recording, is not registering, has no dog in the fight, is not keeping records. And it's like, you know, sipping from that pool. Well, I don't even know if you'd call it consciousness. That's even saying too much. And I guess if you...
Very virtual, like, I don't know how to say that, but...
Yeah. You know, a seeker becomes a seeker because they've caught wind of something. You don't pick up I Am That or Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, or, you know, Be Here Now or whatever the hell you're reading because, you know, for academic reasons. You don't. I mean, you pick it up because, you know, you have a sniff of something. Something is wafted through your life experience, whether... you know, from a prior life or when you were pre-verbal or all throughout the, you know, curious demonstration of your life, and you have this remarkable kind of sacred suspicion. And you forget about it for decades, you know, or years or whatever, and then it sneaks back up on you. And then at some point, you know, you're kind of, you find yourself being, you know, a little bit in and a little bit more in and a little bit more in. And then you go over this event horizon and now you're all in.
Word in.
you have to go all in, right? You have to go all in, because if you think that your so-called spiritual life is going to serve your secular life, you're not all in. You've still got the burden of, you know, let's call it the joy of living, to make it work out in a way that you might be proud of. You're not all in if you're still invested there. And that's fine. I'm not judging anything or anyone. It's just the quality of how fierce is your, is one's, you know, call it insistence, or you could call it a longing or a craving for this companion reality to reveal itself. And you can tell posers from, you know, someone that's bereft.
Crazy
and bereft.
Mad.
For the longing of this, you know, revelation. Because posers, they got shit to tell you. You know, they're gonna self-promote and be all over, you know, it's like the smell of flies on, you know, cow dung. It's like, I was like, there's posers here, I can smell it.
It does seem like you get a lot better at smelling that smell, I swear. You
just, oh, yeah. More,
like, you don't even have to go very near them. You're just like, yeah. You just see yourself. You're like,
yeah. Right. It looks like an aggregate of posers over there. I think I'll walk on the other side of the street. Oh my God, it's an aggregate of posers.
Well, you don't actually have to avoid them. You can stand in the middle of them, really, but you just mm-hmm. want to keep them.
That's right.
They won't even know you're there.
No, they don't. They don't know. They don't notice anything. If you're having even the slightest of a demonstrative rapture, they're not even going to ask you how you're doing.
No, it's funny. You think that someone would be like, dude, you look like you're having a good time. Like, what are you doing? Nope.
No. Mm-mm. No. You're the secret Sufi. You're
like, oh, no, I'm the crazy person in town.
You can have a rapture right in the middle of public and no one would even know.
Yeah, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, usually I think something's wrong with you because I end up like laying on the floor and stuff, you know.
Yeah, right.
Out of the woods somewhere.
Really? Staring at my bubble gum.
Yeah.
What?
Staring at the sky for too long.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's right. That's marvelous. I mean, you know, a certain silence. And silence is not quite the right word. I mean, if consciousness is noise, right? If the fluttering, you know, always on nature of consciousness is noise, then you could refer to these respites as, you know, silence. There's no processing. There's just the remarkable texture of the most subtle of, you know, sensation or attention. Lucid, right? Perfectly lucid. Without content. And that compulsion, that kind of drives our, you know, normal rhythm, normal consciousness cycle, that the rhythm or drive of anticipation, right? It's both anticipation and entertainment. Anticipation and entertainment. Anticipation, entertainment, consideration of the past. Entertainment, anticipation, consideration of the past. entertainment, and they just bounce around. And that's how
the future, which is basically entertainment and whatever.
Yes.
What am I going to do next?
And yep. Yeah, that's right.
How can I make it as great as possible?
Yes. Yes, the demand that, you know, this so-called the creature consciousness makes upon itself, or we think upon us, is this loop of, right, anticipation and demand and past and planning and, yeah, incessant reification. Yeah. Uh-huh. And that, as, you know, formidable as that seems, it's possible for it to just completely, you know, lapse. And it doesn't matter whether that lapse is, you know, permanent, because there's no such thing as permanent. It's like, yeah, no, it just lapses. It's like, get used to the lapse. You know, practical advice, so-called. Hey, you're interested in this kind of shit? Well, simply put, get used to the lapse. Notice the lapse. See how ridiculously organic and effortless it is. The porosity of experience. See what the lapse is made of. And then you could say our attention is shifted from, oh my God, it's me again, spokesmodel, what do we do next? Right? You're like, you're in availability. Even noticing the lapse or being on the lookout for a lapse is the invitation, if not the fruition of it. The inertia of, you know, craving goes. Momentary encounters with lapse are more than sufficient. I would say it's actually, you know, if we're talking about utility, it has more utility than that aching notion of, you know, will I be enlightened and when and will it last? It's like, what? Here's lapse at your feet. Here it is. Here's your liberation. I mean, fuck, here's liberation. This is actually it. And that's just, oh, wow. Yeah, that's right. This is it. There's a lot of fuss made around imagining that I should have and will have, want to have a certain kind of experience. But as long as you're right in anticipation of and projection of having a certain kind of experience, you are not attentive to the porosity of your actual present experience. So you're actually, in a sense, you know, refusing the lapse by projecting yourself as an experiencer into a future.
It doesn't seem like it's just like it becomes easier. You less like refuse it, you know, because, well, in my case, yeah, I mean, all I can say is in my case, but it seems like it is running me through in some sense. Theoretically, obviously, but running me through like all the areas in which I like, and it's running through as like a simulation, not as like actual necessary life events, but like simulations of like recognition of seeing what I dream of, and then like kind of really going through like what is this, and what does, how, you know, it doesn't. It's like you just see through all of it, you know, and some of it like kind of whips up a little and takes a while to. Mm-hmm. You know, pass through and whatever, and but yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that, you know, there's a certain kind of...
instead of getting away from a behavior, you see, you understand in some way, like, what, where it's coming, you know, the root of, like, the stuff kind of starts to...
Yeah. That you could say the addiction of processing present experience, you know, through the spokes model mind.
It's total addiction to data. It's just constant, like... data mining.
Yeah.
And it, yeah. That addiction is really forbid. That's a serious, I don't think anybody really realize how insane that, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, that's right. That's why if you spy an aggregate of muggles, you know, you go to a different restaurant. Yeah.
I guess that's why we stopped going to the Hattery.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that you, you know, you get on a train and then you go to the guest chamber and you don't, you know, try to defend yourself. Maybe it could look like that. I mean, what you do, you know, with respect to the maintenance and safety of the creature is whatever you do, right? According to whatever alarm bells are going off or how you are triggered to, you know, defend or protect yourself under threat. You know, it's not like you're a better person if you, in a sense, you know, consent to be violated. Fight back. But this is more a, you know, it's more a quality, a companion quality of consciousness that's present in its absolute fullness, unfiltered, just as this. It's not about how one is going to behave under hypothetical circumstances. Maybe that's why I enjoy those triggers of, you know, incarceration or being boxed in. Cause they're like membranes, you know, it's like coming up against a membrane of, recoil. You know, you're like recoiling back into the creature sense and triggered and agitated by some kind of, you know, imposition on you that would be in your imagination somehow unbearable. You know, so it's like, you know, it's kind of interesting to lean into those to see like, what's that about? You know, what's the nature of the fear or the identification
that's what I mean.
Triggered.
It's like you run through those in some way and they're very simple. They're disguised as insane. I mean, I don't know, babies getting cancer and Trump becoming president and they're disguised in all this weird shit.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's just, you kind of get to a more core thing and you're like,
right.
Oh, this shit again.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something about, yeah, right. Being, taking the elevator down to the core and you're like, whoa, fuck. Yeah. Seeing in sepia tones, you know, watching a
thing just like dim. When you said that, I was like, what is it? is a cool word.
Yeah, it is fun. I mean, you can ride on certain lofty platforms above your own life and look down and, you know, be in an absolute panic. Right? It's like I look at myself from, a higher platform. Looking at this ant kind of creature, you know, move in and out of his environment and life and appointments and the things he likes to do or doesn't like to do. And it's, you know, it's really like, could you have a more boring movie than that? I mean, does that guy have like any spirit left? He just looks like he's, you know, Jesus Christ. All of the, you know, the rhythms of the habits, meaning, you know, binge watching a show or whatever the hell's going on. You're just
eating the same shit every week at the grocery store. Is like, dude, there's a whole fucking grocery store here. Maybe just branch out a little.
Yeah. There's no point in going beyond the Lucky Charms, if you ask me. I mean, when you hit a magical food like that, I mean, you stay with that.
Throw those in the blender, some milk.
Yeah.
Yum.
Yeah.
No cooking and no dishes.
Yeah. You don't know, I mean, you don't know what you don't actually know what you're doing or what you're made of. Or, you know, whether you're living up to your potential or not. You know, and if someone gets in your face, you know, gets in your grill, as they say, and tells you you're not, well, you don't want to hear that. You're not living up to your potential. You're not branching out. You're not novel. You're not educating yourself. You're not practicing a musical instrument. You're not this. You're not that. You're too this. You're too that. I'm like, God, you're so right about all of that. You know, but I'm not going to change. Oh, my God.
I still keep thinking I'll change, but no.
Yeah.
No, it's like, oh, this is the same.
You know, one of the only ways to change is you just, you know, get rid of all your shit, jump in a Greyhound, and...
I don't think, just follows you.
Yeah, most likely. Most likely I would reconstruct another environment if I had the means, you know, I'd reconstruct another environment, which kind of looked like me again. I'd put peanut M&Ms in the freezer and, you know... I go to Walmart and get a vacuum cleaner. I mean, you know.
You don't even need much. It
would just be me redux.
Yeah. Even if you had a box, it would still just somehow take on.
Yeah. Well, there's a certain, Buddha talked about insight into dukkha or insight into unsatisfactoriness. You know, that was not a trivial encouragement. You know, really going into the very strange textures of living at all and consciousness at all and one's socioeconomic circumstances and way of life and presence or absence of abundance or freedom to come and go. You know, consciousness itself, taking on the patina of corporeal individuation is, in a sense, really quite the bummer. But our tendency is to try to make corporeal individuation the best we possibly can through, you know, whatever creature comforts we're able to amass and attract, you know, with Abraham Hicks and The Secret and getting the love you want. Most of us are so fucked up that if we got the love we wanted, it would be garbage anyway.
Could you imagine? You're seriously addicted to data, and then you give someone, I mean, it's like giving a heroin addict, you know, $1 million. You're like,
Yeah, here's the love you want. Yeah. Here's an endless supply of needles and more smack than you'll know what to do with. In a week's time, you'll be dead. That's getting the love you want. Yeah, you'll be dead in no time. But you can use Silva mind control to get a parking spot.
It's important.
Totally important.
So weird. I ended up randomly listening to some Abraham Hicks thing the other day, and, you know, it was like, part of it was like, I mean, they're ridiculous, you know, but I just stumbled into this thing, this dialogue with Trump. Some guy was all worked up about Trump or something. Whatever her response was lovely, and then, you know, I closed out of that box, and the next thing is like, how to attract money, how to get the most amount of money you can get, you know, or something. I'm like,
right.
What? How the fuck? What?
Yeah.
It's just beyond.
Yeah.
You're like, oh my god.
Yeah, right.
Made me feel dirty for having even watched the first video.
Yeah, you know this. God's not really doing. You know, God's not really working in my favor. I think, you know, I think I may start attracting a lot more money.
I get those thoughts sometimes. Like, maybe I ought to really just concentrate on material worlds and try to.
It doesn't.
Sure.
Usually it's like, why bother?
Yeah, it's work. If you don't need it, you're like, that's kind of a lot of work. I mean, unless you really enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah, I can only be motivated for kind of like 3 to 5 minutes, and it's hard to accomplish much in that time. Oh, that's a good idea. Oh, that's a good idea. Let me get right on that. What was I thinking about? Oh, that's a good idea.
That's a good idea. I just sit down at Google and I'm like,
yeah.
What's I going to look up? I know it.
Yeah.
It was there somewhere.
Yeah. I know how this is going to end. Oh, that's a good idea. But it's maddening, you know, because the addiction to that creates a lot of sorrow.
Well, it seems to have, it's just hard to find that space that you were talking about earlier. That's the kind of, not that they can't be there together, you know, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they absolutely are. Yeah, this is nothing.
It doesn't seem very nourishing, whatever that ritual.
Yes.
I can't have a second to process this. It's total like denial.
Yes.
So fast.
Yes.
That you get to a point where like 1 second alone without data is like, fuck.
Wow.
You know, like, it's crazy. It's like, oh.
Yeah.
This is insane.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we're in such a loop of, you know, denial and projection. Ephemeral, you know, imaginative living.
Well, when you land for a second, you don't know where you are because you're so wrapped up that you can't. It's like reading a book and getting really caught up and then putting it down. You're like, you know, oriented for a minute. You have to like kind of be like, whoa.
Yeah,
where are we again?
and then the habit for reorientation kicks in, you know, so fast. It's kind of like the biological imperative of, you know, creature in a realm is, you know, orienting to its environment, and it's either safe or not safe, or it knows what's coming or not, or it's in anticipation or not. And so that's going on all the time, you know, this crazy, you know, orientation reflex.
Yeah.
And we don't notice, you know, the spaciousness of being when we're enrolled in orientation reflex. And most of us don't see the inherent madness in orientation, having an orientation reflex.
When they can't find any value in having an orientation less kids that we're in right now.
I would say it's more threatening than, let's say, having no value. You know, it's like when people kind of like, well, meditate. Why would you meditate? You know, that kind of thing, which is, of course, is a good question. but it's, you know, I always get a sense that it's a ruse. You know, what appears to be disinterest is
more like a little kid making fun of someone. Why would you do that?
Yeah, I think that's more the ruse.
Why would you want to do that?
I think there's a certain, you know, like, call it semi-conscious or unconscious terror of freedom from orientation.
Filter yet, Francie?
No. And I just keep buying water, and every week I'm like, yeah, we'll just see what happens. Just plowing through plastic jugs.
Adding to global warming.
Yeah. Yeah. Recycling bin is full.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's funny. I keep trying to find some orientation, some maintain it. Maintaining it is the worst fucking part. It's horrible. It's like, no, I'm like an environmentalist. Wait, I need water. For some reason, I made up blah blah blah, and you end up with jugs of water, plastic shit lying around, and you're like,
right. despite your best intentions to contribute to a low carbon footprint.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A low carb and a low carbon footprint.
Both low carb and low carbon. Mm-hmm.
Hard to live by.
Way hard to live by. Yeah. Yeah, I saw myself in a mirror the other day, and I was like, oh, I can't stand to see that. How did that happen?
I like when you catch my under here in a camera, I'm like, what? Turkey
egg?
Yeah. What's that?
If you sit a certain way, you're like, oh, that's good. Like, I have a butt on my face.
No. Right. Yeah. I have to go through all kinds of, like, you know, self-esteem affirmations just to bring myself back from the brink of horrific depression.
That would seem like a lot of work.
It is.
Yeah.
I used to hate that.
I just get high and move on.
That was out there. Just made me feel so desperate, you know?
Nice.
There's no place like home. There's no place like home.
Yeah.
That was the worst of the self-help. Ugh.
Uh-huh.
So many.
Well, I mean, the whole self-help industry, you know, is all about optimizing the, you know, the sentence of being a creature.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Well, we could start a commune and build furniture or something.
Yeah, in Vermont.
Yeah, there you go.
Build furniture out of found wood.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Call it ugly furniture, just because we don't know what we're doing.
Really?
Hey, that's really ugly. That's right.
Better than what you get from China. That's your slogan.
Made in America. by beatniks.
Might only be slightly better than what you find in China. By beatniks. Well, no affinity towards America either. We'll happily exploit the marketing. It's kind of funny, like sometimes I'm like, it would be more refreshing if people were just more, you know, if it was more kind of just honest like that, like, no, I'm just exploiting the marketing, like just, I don't know, more fun, playful.
Yeah.
Everything's like so seriously, obviously, not sincere, but made to look sincere, and you're just like,
yeah.
So, like,
right.
I don't know.
We're just trying to be sincere. We just don't know what to do. It's funny when the anticipatory mind quiets down. It's like the whatever is present in one's vicinity, one's consciousness, somehow becomes, you know, just remarkably intimate or remarkably sufficient, remarkably fascinating, without having to have any utility. You know, normally when we look for the value of things, they have to have some kind of utility for us, you know, sensually, experientially. And that utility is oftentimes, you know, marred or measured by, let's call it time. And that's how we become, what would you say, kind of distracted. Like what's present is non-nourishing to us because we imagine that it's just familiar. Like it's the clutter of my, right? The clutter of my space, the clutter of my life, the clutter of my mind, the clutter of someone I think that I know who I'm meeting again. But in this, you know, other quality of innocence and non-processing. I mean, it's like everything animate or inanimate becomes like more than your best friend. The simplest, call it context of conscious contact doesn't foment into distractibility. Conscious contact itself is, well, it's remarkable. And there's no craving. There's no wish to accumulate or hold, store, right, an object. None. So that sense of what we call psychological time, which operates through, you know, the imagination of future, which is craving, which is self, which is distractibility. That, hi Michael, that quality of consciousness is, well, it's remarkable. And what's even stranger about it, you know, contrary with the way a lot of spiritual stuff is, let's say, you know, taught, is that that companion consciousness is really just this. It's not another place. It's not another time. It's not, you know, the consequence or result of anything. It's just the organic quiescence of the anticipatory mind, of the object finding mind. And then conscious contact itself becomes, blissful. We might say, oh boy, that maybe sounds kind of interesting. I'd like to have that experience. And I mean, yeah, that makes perfect sense. But the odd thing is that I don't know. It doesn't make sense to say you are having that experience, because if you're not noticing it, right, if you're not attuning to that kind of a texture, well, then you're not having that experience.
But if you're holding out, you're just holding out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not doing anything else.
Yeah, it's like, you know, conscious contact itself is liberation. It is without quality, without time or anticipation, without utility. That's maybe one of its more fun aspects. There's no utility. So one is, you know, in a sense, weaning oneself from the consumptive habit of anticipation, the consumptive habit of processing present experience. And there's no way to, you know, do that, because you lift even the smallest finger and you're back in the, the temporal nature of consciousness, the processing, imagining that you're, you know, in a condition or of the nature of a condition. So if I place a lot of emphasis or confidence that I'm in a condition and that condition is somehow less than what I'd like it to be, well, then that's okay. You're in a condition. How do you talk yourself out of the loyalty of imagining that you're in a condition? You can't, because you're in a condition.
You notice it after the fact, which you're telling yourself in the moment, kind of, which so the whole thing's like.
Yeah. Yes. So that's like the subtlety of the, you know, call it the yoga or call it paying attention, is that if you've found enough evidence to suggest that you're in a condition, well, you're in one. So, and trying to get out of the one that you think you're in, that's a waste of time. Because all you're going to find is the myth of another so-called condition. Well, it's kind of like a reverse yoga.
It's like you've created a crossword puzzle, and then you're just trying to solve your own crossword puzzle, and you're like, have fun, because it doesn't end. So this is not an ending crossword.
That's right. That's the spokes model. The spokes model who doubles as a librarian creates the hallucination that I'm in a condition. that and my life has amounted to something, or perhaps my life hasn't amounted to anything, which again is, you know, creature-fying. So it's kind of a very fun, very playful, and, you know, nourishing, call it quality of mind or attention, to see that you're not in a condition and that there is nothing you need do about yourself at all. And then the glow of conscious contact becomes, well, deliciously enthralling, nourishing, and empty of implication. And that's the, you know, call it the companion consciousness to being insane. it's not actually other than being insane. It's kind of fun to look at it, because we think too much in like dichotomy, you know, like being unenlightened is like, well, I know what that is, boy. And that's, you know, that's a blowout. And then so-called the imagination of being enlightened is something other. And no, there's neither. Because anything that's imagined as a context or a set of coordinates for one's experience becomes a condition. And if there's a condition, well, there's an I that's in that condition. Or if there's an I, there's a condition. You know, it's a chicken or egg thing. I don't think it really matters. You know, and then if we like try to build a cosmology around that, then you're going to end up in another ism. That's you know, kind of the perennial problem with even the most sublime, you know, body of teaching, because they're a cosmology that claims that this is a certain way, that's not a certain way, getting from here to there is useful, here's the way to do it, right? And you're like, no. There's no condition. You're not in a condition. And Buddhism is not going to relieve you from the imaginary condition that you're in. Dzogchen is not going to relieve you of that imaginary condition. Nothing is. Because anything that's found and therefore associated with creates an instantaneous cosmology. And the creation of that cosmology is, you could say, tantamount to, you know, I, to individuation. This is really fucked up if there's really nothing to remedy. I guess you could say all this effort that we, you know, may expend over the life of a seeker fucker and doing what we do diligently and sincerely, you know, is useful in that it's kind of an exhaustion process. We're traveling through every cul-de-sac and every, you know, path in the labyrinth that we can find to see what we can discover by going down that path, by doing that practice, by, having a face-to-face with the Minotaur. So we find all kinds of things, whether it's through mindfulness or ayahuasca or radiant presence or whatever. We find all kinds of things, interesting things. And then, you know, at some point we just withdraw completely from the inclination to make even a discovery. And that's unfathomable. I mean, you know, even referring to this is like, no, that's saying too much. That's not quite right. Because there's no actual reference. I mean, how does the mind works by, you know, you could say assigning, right, a code, a catalog number to experience. Oh, I'm cold. I'm warm. It's light. I'm depressed. I'm happy. I've got things to look forward to. Oh, my life is miserable. Oh, I can't do anything about my diet. Oh, I should be meditating more or less. Oh, I missed that meeting. You know, we're cataloging incessantly. And that cataloging of objects found is samsara, is I, is individuation, is distraction. The cataloging. And then the hope of coming to a different kind of condition is also cataloging. And no crime, of course. But seeing it clearly enough, you could say, through the exhaustion of trying to get a leg up on it, through all the practices and, you know, things we may do for, you know, in the name of spiritual understanding. It's just fun to see it self-annihilate. Our bodies age, but we're not actually occurring in time. There's a profound rainbow of sensorium, subtle and not so subtle. And yet there's nothing. No assignment is made. No utility is made. One doesn't derive, you could say, the moniker of experiencing from what we refer to as experiencing. If you're experiencing, then you found too much. You found too much. Call it the subtle plenum of, you know, conceiving, perceiving, what we call experiencing, right? The display, the incredible display, the highly pixelated, remarkable fractal display of the textures of experience, dimension by dimension by dimension by dimension. If you've found something, you're in trouble. Because by finding something, anything at all, that conjures a context or content or category or implication, then that's how self is created. That's how the imagination of being in a condition is actually created. And this is not at your conception or, you know, when you learned to say no at 2 years old or when you were a teenager. No, it occurs right now. That's fun because since it only occurs right now, well, there's your way out. Because if you became a product of conceiving when you were conceived, then, you know, maybe you'd have to wait till death or something. But no, you're a product of conceiving, if you're a product of conceiving here, now, here, now. And because it is not actually made of anything, nor does it have any implication, then the good news is we can be free of the implication of conceiving. Which is also right now. This is the liberation. And it's not, and interestingly enough, it's uneventful.
It's back to that like silence of just, this isn't saying anything.
It's not saying a word.
It's not eventful.
I might talk too much, but it's not saying a word. Yeah. So amidst this incredible tapestry of everything that can be seen and felt and imagined and on and on and on and on, phew, it's absolutely porous. The mind is, right, we call mind, the experiential mind is acquisitive. It wants to understand, or it wants to feel, or it wants some evidence, or it wants, right? And that's the habit of, that's the habit of object seeking and object finding.
It's a story junkie. It just wants like words and sentences and
yeah,
loves stories.
Yeah.
Let me tell you a story.
Yeah. Well, stories, you know, stories as, what could you say, you know, fodder for the being existent.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's a different turn of the screw. You could say to, you know, let's say relinquish the incessant habit or the incessant insistence on being and remaining existent. And then using everything that shows up in the tapestry to prove, once again, my existence, my, you know, right to be, my individuation, and of course all of the cranky entitlements that accompanies that, and I got a load of them. It, you know, in some traditions, there's the mistaken encouragement that one should, you know, control one's mind, or, you know, that one should do something with or about one's mind as if it is somehow a culprit or it can be implicated in one's, you know, irritability. And that's just not true.
Should at least nuke it.
Well,
I mean,
We're looking, you know, it's like, the usual suspects.
Yeah.
Something's wrong. I'm not sure what it is, but I'm going to find out who it is and I'm going to take care of it. Oh, I know. It's my mind. You're like, no, that's not what's happening. That's not what's happening, nor is that the problem. But if you imagine it is, well, I can sell you a Zafu.
Somebody framed the mind, I guess.
Yeah. Simply by imagining that we want to or should blame this on someone or something, get to the bottom of it, and then make the right corrective action. Oh boy, I'm going to sell you a religion.
Hmm.
You know, this emphasis that our dear friend Paul Hederman places on selfing, you know, and that kind of stuff, or, you know, using Ramana Maharshi from time to time. It's all the wrong emphasis, if I can be so, you know, bold. Because now you've found, oh, the reason you're suffering, the reason you're an idiot, the reason you're an addict, the reason you keep drinking and, you know, going out with the wrong people is because you're selfing. Why didn't you tell me? I'll just stop selfing. But there is no selfing. Selfing is not made of anything. It's not actually doing anything. It can't be the culprit nor it can't be responsible for having any outcome at all. Once you say, oh, this is what's going on and this is the outcome that it has, and therefore you should adjust or adopt or steer yourself in a more cogent utilitarian direction so that you can get out from under the influence of this thing that we've decided is the reason you're an idiot. Well, I've just sold you a religion. I've just sold you traveling lighter.
Nobody knows. It was really funny. It's popping in my head, but I was listening to someone talk about they were trying to get computers to do this kind of stuff because they're like, well, I don't know. Like, how do you determine what we should have done to, like, not be – to how do you get out of war or whatever, like all the weird pieces in a century that, or decade that we go through. It's like – and they were doing all these weird games like tit for tat, you know, which is like – and it's like two lines of code. You're like, how do you know – you can't code that kind of shit, you know? And there's all these different games they were coming up with, and it's like none of it worked. Like, the Jesus game didn't work, you know? Yeah. Just be good all the time, just be bad all the good time. Tit for tat didn't work. None of it is quite, you know? Yeah.
That's right.
You can't come up with a game. AI can't come up with a game strategy either, you know? It's like, give it up.
Accusation of any kind is untrue. It's just improvisationally, hypnotically suggested. But we might feel more secure if we knew why we were suffering the way that we do, if we do, and then what we should do about it, and then we can judge ourselves pretty much every day, all day, for whether what we're doing about it is the right thing to be doing about it, and whether I have sufficient verve to really get to the bottom of this, or whether I'm just kind of a superficial entertainer. That's the loop that you get locked into when someone creates a cosmology and therefore suggests to you that you are the way you are because of something, and then here's a cogent way out, like sitting on a cushion or standing on your head.
Or just run the tit-for-tat game according to your life, you know, hit the button and see what happens. Let the computer do it.
Yeah.
Two lines of code. It'll do it.
I mean, it's such a fun, curious, if not infuriating paradox. It's like there's a discovery to be made, but there's no discovery to be made. There is, for sure, I call it a companion consciousness, which is not participating in or is not afflicted by the imagination of self in a world. But we become approach driven so quickly that the mind is once again hypnotized into some kind of, you know, corporeal condition, emotional, spiritual, psychic, whatever condition, and then craves some kind of release from that condition. With the cessation of a remedial or acquisitive approach to present experience, reveals I don't know. different dimension of something, immersion. You could say that all the contemplative training that we might do well, you know, in a way is preparatory for being able to tolerate lapse.
I think sometimes when you've done contemplative practices for so long, it becomes a part of your life and you don't really see it. You don't notice it quite so much anymore. And that becomes sort of like a different life in some way.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Although I don't know what that means, but.
Right. Yeah. Well, the formality, if there is any formality to, you know, sitting or being silent or being still, you know, at one time may have been something that was cultivated with, you know, sincerity and verve and regularity. And then it's just so organic. I mean, there's, you know, one isn't seeking to derive anything from it any longer.
You know, there seems to be a really fine line between, you know, and a practice that you're a part of, in sort of an awakeful manner. But that's just a characterization.
Yeah. I mean, we realize that's what we have. You know, we have these poetic improvisationally appearing characterizations and they're lovely. I mean, they're all blooming flowers.
I was just recently in a conversation with a bunch of sort of techie folks, of all things, about a poem by William Blake, and he talks about the name of the poem is The Tiger, and he wonders whether or not, in so many words, he wonders whether or not God, you know, how it is that God could create such a terrifying thing as a tiger, and yet also a lamb at the same time. And so that sort of exposes the craziness of polarities, you know, good, bad, right, wrong, left, right. You know,
that was my vivid dream from earlier this morning.
Really?
There was the tiger and the lamb, yeah.
You're kidding.
No.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Wow. Well, it's a very short poem. You would have visited Blake.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and they don't, you know, they don't get, you know, the difference between sort of scientific, explanations and ones that aren't trying to explain, but merely instead try and present. I mean, that's sort of what artists, you know, do is they're expressing themselves. They're attempting to see the vision or so.
The poetry of being is intimacy. Yeah. That's, you know.
Okay, I'll go for that.
When we're at our best, that's, you know, that's where and how we meet.
Yeah. Anyway, it's, I do still some of these practice, well, really only one. I do practice. I've been doing practice for ages now, but it just doesn't, I don't go into it. You know, it's just such a habit now to me.
Sure.
And there's something that's, I find, there's almost something holy about just
yeah.
yourself from routine Yeah. I'm not exactly there, but yet obviously I am there, and I don't know. It's hard to put into words.
The holy is this. It is this presence. It is this, you know, liberated impossibility. This is the holy.
Yeah.
Moving through it, you know, with distractibility and crankiness and craziness is like, okay. And moving through it or attending to it through formal practice or informal practice or the simple, you know, innocence of lapse is like, rock on.
I like, and this is what I've been liking about Lark. I like, although I complain a lot about it, but I like about being groundless. I like about being off kilter, off center, unbalanced, challenged, nervous. I mean, I'm not really nervous, but
sure.
Those lines. I mean, it seems most whatever I am at those points in time, whatever the hell that is.
Yeah, I mean, you know, however consciousness is showing up, however life experience is showing up, I mean, it's certainly, you could say it's, you know, it's lovely to be welcoming.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
For you and your two guests here, my wife and I recently retired, and my wife's ahead of me by a couple months or so because she got here earlier than I did. And I've been finding that being no longer being directed by others or by a situation that I find myself in.
Wow.
It's been really sort of disconcerting in a way. I mean, to be totally self-directed.
Yeah.
Very challenging.
Yes.
And I'm not too sure they really want to do it.
Yes. I understand. Sure. Yeah.
So that's been sort of shaking my ground a little bit. I'm surprised I felt my wife would that much.
Yeah. 20 hours a week at the grocery store will fit the bill just, you know, perfectly. Wearing your Piggly Wiggly apron and putting groceries in a bag and saying, have a lovely day. You'll be the secret Sufi. Yeah. I'm the same way. I mean, I don't work in an office or, you know, I'm self-employed, but
yeah.
I see the, you know, the interest, the utility, the life-affirming nature of having appointments and clients and things to do and keep myself busy and, you know, make whatever income I make from it. Yeah. If I were really self-directed, you know, I don't know what I would do.
Right. Right. You know, whatever those things happen to be, I'm finding it's been instructive to sort of embrace them. And my mother just had her 90th birthday. She came down here. I had all my sisters here, which are five of them. So it's all moving.
Wow. Party.
I fought for 2 days and finally the second two days, I just threw my hands up and said, you know, whatever you all want to do.
You didn't know better to do that on day one.
I'm the oldest of the siblings, so
I
had a position of, I don't know, whatever it was, but.
Yeah, chauvinistic authority. The one brother of the six siblings.
Yeah, right. Anyway, everything's just interesting. I don't know what to say. I don't understand almost any of it anymore these days.
Well, you know, like you said, whatever's appearing in consciousness as a present experience or the recollection of a prior experience is a flower blooming in presence. And if we, as you can see, as we invest in the way these stories arise and whether they have implication, then we can move into, you know, that dreamy condition of imagining ourselves to be corporeal and temporal and space and time and implication and the things that we can say about our social existence, right? And that's great, all well and good. The other, you could say as a complement to that, not an alternative to it, but as a complement to it, there is just this inscrutable and excruciating intimacy.
It leaves me a little schizophrenic at this stage of wherever it is I'm into. On the one hand, I feel like I've got one foot in conventional reality for more reasons than I can count.
All involuntary.
I didn't choose them.
That's right. That's right.
And then the other, you know, the other foot is, I don't know how else to put it. I'm sort of an emptiness. And I don't even know if I'm trying to balance or negotiate or.
Well, anything I say about myself or you say about yourself, as you take a lofty position and look down and then create an assessment meme for your life, is just, again, you know, presently imagined.
Yeah.
It's not true.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, one of the fun things that we have to cope with. You know, we think that freedom is just going to be whatever the people at TM say it's going to be. But what if it were like, you know, this startling revelation that, oh, Jesus, anything that appears in mind, you know, as an assessment vector or a desire vector or entertaining myself or whatever is absolutely impersonally and spontaneously appearing.
Right.
And I really don't have a story to tell. Though I can tell a million of them.
Right.
And part of that, you know, yoga, I would, you know, in I guess what I would call my experience, though, that's been just horrible and shitty and nothing to talk about. It's like
a dream this morning.
Yeah, well, once in a while you get a good dream. But you have to use cold drugs to do it. it's always this curious, you know, let's call it a return from, oh, I am telling myself a story. Oh, I'm self-assessing. Oh, I'm placing myself in a context. Oh, I'm feeling good or bad or indifferent about something, to just this really, you know, I mean, it's a truly intolerable intimacy. And that's why there's that, you know, that the yoga of getting accustomed to, consciousness without, right, without a vector. Cause it, I mean, it's like, it's, phew, it rocks. It's dangerous. It's lethal, right? Intimacy is lethal. Conscious contact is lethal. Bliss is lethal. And when we encounter it not as an object, it's like seriously lethal.
Powerful. Whatever.
Really? So our, you know, our task, it's kind of like, it's funny. It's like, I'm seeking. It's like, whoa, I found something. You know, it's that paradox again. There's nothing to discover, but fuck, there's really something to discover. And then in that discovery, it's like, how do I refrigerate this? How do I refrigerate myself?
We're like, you know, addicted to time travel.
You could.
I mean, that's kind of what we're doing. If going out in imagination via time generally is how we go out in imagination.
Yeah.
Time travel.
Yeah, that's right.
Like addicted to going time traveling and collecting objects.
Yes. Yeah, it's like playing a video game. I'm running through imagination, collecting power objects, healing objects, weaponry, you know, that I can use on my so-called enemies, which happens to be myself. Yeah.
Change my hair.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, we're delightfully pathetic. And then there's this companion intimacy, which is simply not going to assign itself
yeah.
to anything.